Democracy is awesome. It's resilient. It is worth nurturing and protecting. And even now, there is hope that we can. These are the conclusions in my last two episodes, but they are not enough. In today's episode, why that's so and what we can do about it. You're listening to I Heart This. I'm Ben Lord. Let's talk about what we love. At the end of January, my mom and dad came to visit and to celebrate my mom's birthday. But over breakfast on Sunday morning, the conversation turned to our fear and sadness over the administration's dismantling of so many democratic institutions. I shared some of my thoughts from the last episodes about hope and how we find it. And my dad listened thoughtfully for a bit and then said, "But Ben, I don't feel hopeless. I feel helpless." And as soon as he said it, I realized just how right he was. I mean, what does hope matter if it's completely out of my hands? As my uncle and good friend put it after reading a draft of my previous episodes, "But what do you want me to do?" And my first reaction was, "Well, I don't know. I'm a science teacher who podcasts about appreciation. I'm just trying to celebrate how awesome democracy is and remind people that we have a chance to save it if we're brave." But even as I said it to myself, I knew it wasn't enough. Lying in bed at night, I'm asking the same questions. How do I help? What do I do? After my mom and dad packed up and said their goodbyes, I spent a long time mulling over my dad's statement. My first thought was, well, maybe all it takes is to just jump in. After an earthquake, no one person can rebuild a crumbled city, but nobody tries. They just start passing out bottled water or picking through the rubble. So I asked myself what I could do right now with what I already have. Here's what I came up with. First, I carved out a regular time to work on this. I made specific appointments like 7 to 8 o'clock on Thursday, and I put it in my calendar. I decided to treat this like any new habit or resolution. So I'm telling people about my commitment, just like I'm telling you now. The simple act of writing something on my calendar was surprisingly settling. But I realized I didn't want to do this alone. Part of what makes me feel helpless is feeling isolated. So as my second step, I decided I needed to join up with others. Now, joining is something I've always done. I've been a longtime member of my local NPR station, the ACLU. A couple years ago, I joined my local library board. But I wanted something more. I wanted something local, something face-to-face that was working directly on preventing the Trump administration from consolidating autocratic power and targeting minority groups. I wanted to sit down with friends. I didn't want to be alone. And after the first Trump election, Laura and some of our friends did just that. They called it the huddle, and they met once a month. It was a kind of democracy club, and it was really powerful. So much so that state officials and candidates and even our lieutenant governor would come to visit them and listen to what they had to say. So, just a couple of days ago, I set out to find a similar group. And it didn't take long to find one. Met every month and is in the town nearby. But I thought even if I hadn't found something, it wouldn't have been that hard to start. It could be as simple as getting a cafe table with a few friends who are also hungry to feel not helpless. But then what would we do? One of the key reasons I feel helpless is because of the crushing magnitude of it all. I know that I need early wins to keep myself going. So my third step was this: pick one goal, make it small, something that we can accomplish with just the resources we have in, say, 3 months. Something that smacks of love and liberty and truth. Something that we could do locally, but with ripples that, however small, might extend through the whole disaster. And I imagined reaching that one modest goal, throwing a party, inviting more friends to it, inspiring them, asking them to join us, picking a slightly bigger goal, moving forward. And I realized that opportunities to help are everywhere. They're small, but so am I. I'm just making this up as I go, but that's what people do in floods and fires and other disasters. It's like Barbara Kingsolver said in our last episode, We can't save everything all at once, but it is still worth saving something because there are so many of us to do it. And so right now, I am grateful for this. We are not helpless. There is no shortage of things we can do. Any of us, no matter our talents, can find some small way to take action. We can start here and now with just the people around us. So that was my outline for this episode. And when I'd written it out, I thought that maybe, you know, I'd flesh it out and it'd be done. But I was so wrong. Oh my God, you guys, it is so hard to listen to the endless stream of disasters on the news. Not long after I'd finished my little I'm Not Helpless action plan, I listened to news reports on the radio on the way into town. And Trump was ordering another slew of supposedly independent agencies to submit to his direct control. Next to that, my little list of humble actions felt like a joke. And I lay awake that night, tossing and turning. It wasn't enough to do something. This isn't about assuaging my feelings of helplessness. If my actions don't have some effect, are they really any better than doing nothing at all? It's not enough to be hopeful and helpful, I realized. The hope and the help have to be connected. I mean, what are me and my little group of friends going to do against the massive power of the administration and the billionaires? Write letters? Make posters? Hold bake sales? Even if 1,000 little democracy clubs sprang up all over the country, what effect would any of that have on the steamroller that is crushing one check on executive power after another? I didn't just want to feel not helpless. I wanted to actually be not helpless. It wasn't enough to see how I could get started. I needed a vision of a possible endgame. I needed a series of steps that might possibly lead from where we are now to a future where my kids could feel secure in their freedom of speech and a free press and a government that acknowledged, represented, and was beholden to its citizens. And I couldn't. Through this whole series, I've been avoiding talking about strategy. I'm not an organizer. I don't know how to do this. I don't have advice about that. But I'm realizing right now that I will feel helpless until I can see a strategy that makes sense. And maybe that's the heart of what my dad was saying. We need more than something to do. We need to see the strategy. We need to see a logical series of steps that could get us from where we are to where we want to be and think, gee, that just might work. The trick is that any strategy that relies on the people is going to need something else. It's going to need leadership. Now, I have never been a follower. I'm a go-my-own-way kind of guy who'd rather sit out than have to follow somebody else's plan. But I am way outside my comfort zone here, people, and I'd be really, really grateful for some leadership right now. And when it comes to people power, go your own way doesn't really cut it. We've all got to push together if we want to move anything at all. But imagine how hopeful it would feel to find somebody with a diagram up on the board that showed the way there. Well, damn, if we had that and a well-organized grassroots engine, I think we'd have a shot. So I did what any 21st century guy does and went online looking for some leadership. And mostly, I saw people flailing around just like me. People wondering out loud where the Democratic Party leadership was, complaints that they weren't doing anything, and resentful rejoinders at them to do your job. Yeah, needless to say, didn't find what I was looking for. Right now, we don't have a Martin Luther King or a Gandhi, but we do have something. As I dug deeper, I found a group doing something with a bit of momentum. And I found another, and then another. You've probably heard of the 50-51 protests. Right now, they are rallying the momentum for another round. And while protests and rallies on their own may not be enough to change political outcomes, it's really disappointing when a potential autocrat makes a power grab and you don't see them. Am I right? These protests might just be a signal, but I'll tell you, right now, I need signals. Some nice, loud, clear ones. I need to know that other people out there care enough to show up. And I am really grateful that people are. Here's another. Did you know that the group Indivisible basically is a roadmap for just the kind of local face-to-face democracy club that I'd been daydreaming about a day before? They have a literal instruction manual. Did you know that the nonpartisan democracy advocacy group called Common Cause has over 1.5 million members and truly is nonpartisan? Right now, they are pressuring the administration to fire Elon Musk. Do you know about Democracy 2025? It's a coalition of over 350 organizations with more than 800 lawyers and other experts. They formed explicitly to confront the threats to our checks and balances posed by Project 2025, and they have been chasing that goal relentlessly. In my own county, a local action network formed by my neighbors under the first Trump administration is applying years of experience to new challenges. And later today, my senators and congresswomen are showing up to a virtual town meeting to fill Vermonters in on what they're doing and how we can help. Here's my point. There are allies out there. There is leadership out there. There are people out there working hard already to do what they can. Maybe our generation's Martin Luther King is already organizing, and we just don't know who they are yet. I still don't know what an overall strategy looks like. But for the first time since November, I'm starting to imagine one. I mean, what if local and state governments across the country refuse to cooperate in the inhumane treatment of their neighbors? What if people from professions across the country go on strike until we get our checks and balances back? What if protesters block key infrastructure until presidential overreach is rectified? Actions like this are going to take planning and organizing and time and sacrifice, but there is no way worth going in this life that is easy and secure. There are leaders who started working and planning this stuff long before people like me even showed up. If we have a democracy a generation from now, it will be because of them. They deserve our help, and they deserve our gratitude. And not just them. If our leaders now have organizations and playbooks for fighting tyranny, it's because they inherited them. 2 centuries ago, abolitionists organized an underground railroad. And 100 years later, women chained themselves to buildings and went on hunger strikes determined to win themselves the right to vote. And 80 years ago, the people of India threw off colonial rule by defying British monopolies until India became virtually ungovernable as a colony. Lessons learned there informed the American civil rights movements, where bus boycotts and sit-ins and freedom rides and marches chipped away at the injustices of segregation. A few decades later in South Africa, the African National Congress organized civil disobedience campaigns that simultaneously made the racism of apartheid untenable from within and galvanized allies around the world to apply pressure from without. In 1986, when Ferdinand Marcos, dictator of the Philippines, claimed to have won a sham election, the Catholic Church and defectors from the military threw their support behind the peaceful protesters crowding the streets, and they toppled his regime. South Korea, France, Ukraine, Spain, Georgia, Serbia, Tunisia, Egypt, Finland, every one of those countries is a similar story. As uncertain and frightening as it may be, history has shown that however we may feel, we are not helpless. We have actions we can take, we have people to take them with, and we have leaders who are already pointing the way. If they're not a movement yet, it's because they're only missing one thing. Us. They need us to not feel helpless or tired or overwhelmed. They need us to believe. On a crisp autumn day in November of 1863, about 15,000 people turned out to dedicate a new national cemetery in the tiny town of Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. 4 months before, Union and Confederate armies had converged there in a devastating battle. The number of casualties was more than three times the size of the assembled crowd. The surrounding land still bore the scars, splintered trees, damaged buildings, fences riddled with bullets, and the shallow graves of the hastily buried dead. At the moment that they gathered there, the work to move the bodies to the new cemetery was still ongoing. On that day, the future of American democracy was arguably even less certain than it is now. The ceremony itself was unremarkable. There was a band, an opening prayer, a benediction. The keynote speaker was a former senator and a distinguished orator named Edward Everett. His two-hour speech told the story of the war and the Battle of Gettysburg and honored the sacrifice of the men and mostly boys who had died. It was widely considered a masterful remembrance, even though it is largely unknown today. At the end, Abraham Lincoln, the Union's embattled president, stepped to the podium. He was getting ready to run for a second term, and his prospects were uncertain. People felt helpless and tired and overwhelmed. Many criticized the president's handling of the brutal war, and while he had strong support from the abolitionists, he was widely seen as a divisive figure by moderates. He spoke for 2 minutes, and all through these past weeks, his words have been playing in my mind. And whatever your political leanings, I hope you find inspiration in them now. 47 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty, and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation, or any nation so conceived and so dedicated, can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives that that nation might live. It is altogether fitting and proper that we should do this. But in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate. We cannot consecrate. We cannot hallow this ground. The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here, have consecrated it far above our poor power to add or detract. The world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us, the living, rather, to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion. That we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from the earth. So, Abe, this may not be the last full measure of devotion, but here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to show up to that meeting on Saturday. And somewhere near you, dear listener, there is one just like it, hosted by someone who is looking for hope and hoping that someone will show up. They're hoping for you, and they don't even know you yet. And every time one of us comes through that door, they'll believe a little bit more that a new birth of freedom is possible. And so will I. Please consider joining or making some kind of regular action group near you, even if it just starts with a regular coffee date. Make the call now while you're thinking about it. Put it on your calendar, text a few friends. You can look for nearby Indivisible groups on their website. I'll put a link in the show notes, as well as links to other organizations I mentioned here, as well as my getting started checklist for what it's worth. If you've got other good resources, please let me know on Facebook or in the comments on YouTube. And thank you for being a part of this. Tune in next week for our final installment of this series on democracy. And iHeart This's very first interview with Vermont State Representative Mike Merwicki. iHeart This is a new episode every Wednesday. It is written, edited, and produced by me, Ben Lord. Our logo was designed by Bryony Morrow-Cribbs. Our theme song is used with permission from neosounds.com. Our website is iHeartThisPodcast.com. We're on Facebook at iHeartThisPodcast. And thank you so much for listening. And, as always, be kind, be curious, and be thankful.